I'm Steve Gilman, and this is Brand Story, where we help you build stronger, more sustainable brands by sharing insightful conversations with brand leaders, marketers, and professional storytellers. My guest today is Tom Landgan.
If you ever find yourself chasing trends, you're going to find yourself on a hamster wheel, and you're never going to get to where you want to go, right? Because if it's a trend, you're already too late. You're already behind.
Tom is a two-time Emmy Award-nominated director of photography and founder of Talex Media, a media production company focused on humanizing the world of business through better communication. He is also the author of the book Legendeering, a guide for a video communication strategy based on the power of authentic human relationships. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Brand Story.
Hey, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. I've been following you for a while on LinkedIn and interacting with you. And I know we have Will Gadara, who is a guest of ours, is a old friend of yours. And so it's really fun to have you on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's amazing how small a place the world can be with technology. So yeah, it's great to be here.
I love how you can meet friends of friends. And, you know, like we were just joking before we started recording, like this is the first time I've seen you move because I've just seen your picture, you know, beyond seeing videos of you. So you've been in production for a really long time. So how did you get into the production world?
Really by accident.
Yeah.
That is the honest answer. So when I was a psychology major in college, and I decided not to go to graduate school, and I was coming up into the second semester of my senior year, and my parents said, if you're planning to move back to New York — I went to college in Pennsylvania — they said, if you're planning to move back to New York with us, you're welcome to do that, but you got to get a job.
That seems fair. Right?
And which is totally fair. Yeah. In hindsight.
Sure. Good
absolutely
advice.
Absolutely 100% agree. Right. Right. At the time, I was a little bit stressed about it because I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was graduating with a degree in psychology, and I wasn't going to graduate school, and there's not a lot you can do directly with a bachelor's in psychology. And so I really didn't know. I was kind of aimless in terms of what my prospects were. So fast forward to like March of my senior year, around this time, actually, and speaking to a friend of mine from high school, telling her that my parents are really getting on my case to find a job when I graduate. And she says, well, why don't you call my dad? And I kind of paused and said, well, why would I call your dad? Like, what are you talking about? And her father owned a production company. And she said, well, he knows you. He's starting a new show. And he may have some entry-level openings for a production assistant role. And if he does, because he knows you, because he can trust you, because he knows you'll work hard, he'll probably give you an entry-level job. And at least then it'll give you something to do and get your parents off your back while you figure out your long-term game plan. And I was like, okay. So I called her dad. And he said, yeah, you know, like, look, if the timing works out, we'd be happy to have you for an entry-level job. There's no, you know, no prerequisites, really. It's, can you carry stuff? Can you take a coffee order? You know, can you move things from here to there? Very basic, you know, sort of grunt work, right? And low man, you know, on the bottom rung of the ladder, so to speak. And so, so he put me on the phone with his production manager. His production manager said, when can you start? And I said, well, I graduate. It was Mother's Day of 2001 when I graduated from college. And so I said, well, I can start. I need time to move back to New York, but I could start the following week. So 8 days after I graduated from college, I started my first job working in television as a production assistant.
Crazy.
On a Columbia TriStar show called Shipmates. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
So did you just fall in love with it? How did you get from there to where you are right now? What really did it for you to make you fall in love with telling stories with cameras?
Yeah. So I think I was always enamored with visual storytelling to some degree. I had actually gotten really into photography, still photography, when I was a kid. My parents got me my first camera when I was 13. It was a birthday present. They got me a 35mm film camera. It was a Pentax K1000, I think. And they gave me that camera, and I kind of fell in love with being able to tell stories in a single image, right? I took photography as like sort of an elective course through high school. And then I kind of put the camera down when I got to college. But doing this job in television enabled me to do a couple of things. One, it gave me a lot of variety in the work that I was doing, which really kind of suited my personality. I'm definitely not the kind of person that would be content doing repetitive tasks or the same task over and over again, you know, over a long period of time or a very kind of narrow job focus. I like doing a lot of different things because I'm sort of a perpetual learner. And so I love getting to develop skill sets.
Yeah. Anyone that works in video production or production has to be fall in love with solving problems because every situation you shoot in is a new challenge you have to solve, a new puzzle.
Yeah. It's creative problem solving. I mean, and probably, you know, very similar things true for you and the work that you do, right? It's creative problem solving.
Yeah. I mean, I had a photo minor in college. I still shoot photography to this day. I do a lot of street photography. We have a lot of photographers here, all of our producers and you know, cinematic video guys are photographers at heart. So visual storytelling, I think, is a really powerful thing. If you fall in love with it, you're just in love with it. And then I think it's really interesting that you studied psychology and ended up being a visual storyteller, because I had a theater background, ended up in brand and marketing. And I think, you know, a lot of the greatest editors that I've worked with are either from music backgrounds or psychology backgrounds, or sometimes, you know, mixed media backgrounds, art backgrounds, photography backgrounds. So did it just spark your creativity? And what kind of stuff have you worked on? Because you've had a long career to get to the point where we're going to talk about your book. So we could spend all day talking about it. But yeah, give me some highlights.
I mean, I've worked on all kinds of stuff. I've done everything from that very first project was a dating show. Went on to work in real estate. I've done some work in fashion. I've done, you know, a whole bunch of different unscripted programming. Some I'm more excited about than others. But you know, everything from, you know, shows like What Not to Wear and While You Were Out, on the sort of TLC and Discovery family of networks, to, Wife Swap on ABC, that was on ABC at the time, to Made on MTV. And then probably my favorite, the highlight for me, and I talk about it in the book, actually, was Coast Guard Alaska. Really, I think it's funny because at the time, obviously, I had no idea, and I think this is kind of a universal human experience, that when you're thinking on something shifts or you change your perspective on things, you don't realize it in real time. It's only, you know, by virtue of hindsight that you can look back and go like, oh yeah, that was where that started to happen. But working on Coast Guard Alaska was really when I started to fall out of love with television, but really entrench my belief in the power of telling stories well. Because that was what we were tasked with on that show. It was part of our commission with the Coast Guard, part of the sort of deal that was struck, was that we were not permitted to do recreations. So when we were there, we had to film what happened and then tell the story in to the best of our ability after the fact through interviews and well thought out pieces of film work and storytelling to really capture a moment, because we couldn't recreate anything.
You really fall in love with the human part of it instead of the very stage scripted, you know, controlled environment of TV production, you know? And I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah. I think really what it was I think you hit on something there when you said I fell in love with the human part of it, because that's exactly what it was. It wasn't, you know, so much of, you know, reality TV is a marketing term that is a very blatant misnomer, right? There's nothing real about reality TV, which we've all heard a million times at this point, but
yeah, so staged.
Yeah. There's nothing real about it. But I really love, you know, scripted fiction, you know, as a consumer of content, as somebody who watches shows and series. Like I'm watching the series Shogun right now, right? that's sort of pop, that's very big in the sort of popular consciousness, right?
It's pretty great. Yeah.
Which is beautifully done. But I love those kinds of things too, because they deal with the very sort of human elements of storytelling. And one of the things I say to people all the time, when you talk about crafting communications for people, is that people are people, right? The technology that we use changes, the modalities that we employ, the mediums through which we tell stories change, right? But at the end of the day, people are people. And all you really have to get right is talking to them like they're people.
Yeah. I mean, we're all little empathy machines running around feeling our way through the world. So when we see a bit of media that makes us feel something, you know the difference. You know what, there's things that might make you laugh or things that might make you think, but there, when you see a piece of media that makes you feel, like, it really connects with you, because that's really how we're built. That's how we process the world. You and I had talked before we set this up that we just kind of felt like we probably had a lot in common, just from, you know, reading each other's stuff and looking at, you know, I'd listen to podcasts you were on. I think you'd listen to ours. And, you know, so I started in documentary filmmaking, working with Greenpeace. And then we brought that kind of approach actually to working on the driest thing in the world, training for Postal Service employees. Because, you know, who likes a training video, right? They suck. They're the worst. You want to kill yourself when you're watching one. And if you have a huge audience to train, they were getting done in the exact same way. You've seen it. We've all seen the formula. So we just decided to do it as a documentary. So we followed real people, real stories, scripted nothing, discovered the story, and then made it fit the points, because it was pretty easy. You know, got it organically to fit the points that they needed to make. And their audience, which was hundreds of thousands of employees, really responded. So do you find, as you were doing the Coast Guard show, that like trying to find the story was more fun for you, or what was it about it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think, because for me, as somebody who's spent, you know, 20, now it's coming up on 22, 23 years in May, doing this kind of work, the stories kind of jump out at me. Right. I'm able to see the story very quick because I've got a lot of training.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of reps.
Yeah. I did some back of the napkin math. This was a few years ago. Somebody asked me, we were talking about the 10,000 hour rule, right? That Malcolm Gladwell popularized. And there's a whole bunch of debate about whether or not that's how much water that holds, but be that as it may, we were talking about that, and they said, how many hours do you think you have in production? And I was like, you know what? Let's figure this out. Like, let's just do a rough estimate. So I just did some quick, like, back of the napkin math, nothing fancy, nothing super accurate.
Yeah.
But I came up with about 45,000 hours.
So a little bit.
So I've got a little bit of experience, right? And so for me, and that's why I say, like, I want to contextualize that.
Yeah.
When I say the stories jump out at me, it's because I've put that time in, right? It's not because I'm special, right?
No, I can relate to that. Experience matters, because the reps, the having been in situations, so they remind you of other situations. And honestly, I think you develop a sixth sense for story. You know, I'm the same way. I've been doing this. This is our 29th year in business. So I've been doing visual storytelling for 30 years. And honestly, so many edits back, doing edits back in Green Valley Suites or Grass Valley Suites, like working in like, so all the way through before, you know, we could edit on our computers, so many edit sessions, so many shoots, so many client conversations about creative, that story becomes, you just see it and feel it everywhere.
Well, and I think like the stories, it was never like about trying to find the story for me so much as it was like the challenge was trying to get the story that I could see,
yeah,
visible to somebody who hadn't put in all of those reps, right? Somebody who didn't have, you know, tens of thousands of hours of experience pulling story out of circumstances, right? That was the fun challenge, is sort of how do I assemble this thing that I know is there in a way that makes sense to an audience that doesn't have all the context that I have.
Yeah, that's so cool, man. That's a very empathic, very human process too. It's a lot of instinct and skill and memory and intuition. So yeah, I think that's really cool. All right. I want to dive in and talk to your book about your book now, because I think all of this kind of informs your book, which is why I wanted to spend a little time just talking about you and how you look at this stuff. So your book's called Legendeering. And I want to make sure it's a word that doesn't, for me at least, legendeering. How do you say it?
Legendeering.
Legendeering. I'm making it harder than it is. So one of the cool things I love about it was that your core principle was lead with value always. Man, I didn't say it that way, but I've said a similar thing about how we serve clients, how you produce media. You know, can you just kind of tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that and why it's so important to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to leading with value, the idea behind sort of making that the central principle of the book, right? Like the pillar that holds up this whole strategy of legendeering, was really based on, again, going back to my background in psychology, right? Was really built around this idea of the rule of reciprocation, right? Which we're taught from before we can even speak, our parents start to teach us to follow this rule. When they teach their very young children, you know, before you can talk, 18 months old, your parents are handing you something, right? And you, as you reach up to take it from them, they say to you, and now you say thank you, or words to that effect, right? And we're being taught from the time we're pre-verbal to give gratitude when we're given a gift, that we cannot take or receive anything without giving in return. And that overarching principle, which social psychologists call the rule of reciprocation, they've found to be societally universal around the world. In other words, there is not an organized society that has been studied by sociologists where this rule of reciprocation does not exist in some form, right? It is sort of a universal human truth. And I thought, you know, what better a foundation to build this strategy on than a universal human truth that is instantly relatable to everyone, right? We all kind of intuitively understand it.
Yeah, I think reciprocity is so incredibly powerful. You know, I think we use it all the time. It's what connects us. You know, some people misuse it, but, you know, there's a lot of sales based on reciprocity that I think none of us like. But I think when it's used honestly, it's probably one of the most powerful things that connects us. So how did you get from that idea to wanting to write this book? And can you just kind of tell the audience a little bit about why the title and why a book right now? Because I think it's so cool. You're a production guy and you wrote a book. You didn't make a video.
Well, I've never been accused of being short-winded. And so I think if I were to try to make a video, it would have ended up being, a three-part feature-length series at minimum, probably. That would have just been scratching the surface.
A 16-hour opus.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been, you know, my Lord of the Rings trilogy, right? But not nearly as interesting to a lot of people. But so I think a book really was the right medium, and I think it was for a couple of reasons. And I talk about this right up front. I sort of address the elephant in the room in the introduction, right? And I say okay, why am I this video guy writing a book? And it really was because I think it's the right medium, because I think books are a much better reference material than video is, right? Video is a cleaner, faster, more impactful mode of communication, but it's not as good for reference as a book is, right? So it's a better reference material. And also because I know, again, from my background in psychology, that the way we form memories is impacted by how many senses we involve in the behavior or the action that we're engaging in, right? And so the nice thing about a book is that it engages three senses simultaneously, right? Sometimes four even. So we get touch, we get sight, right? And then you get hearing the sound of the page turning, right? The crinkle in your hand, the sound of the pages moving against each other. And also sometimes smell, right? The smell of a book. Paper has an odor to it, right? Books smell like books. Right. There is a descriptor when you walk into a library, it smells like books. Or when you walk into a bookstore, it smells like books. It smells like paper. Right. So So there are multiple senses engaged, which makes it more likely that you'll retain some of the information. And then lastly, because it's a little bit more interactive than video, in that the people who buy my book, who read my book, who want to use it as a reference material, can go through and highlight sections. They can underline things. They can dog ear pages, right?
Yeah. It's really handy to be able to go back and find things that you read once and look at them again. I have a Kindle like a lot of people. So some books I read on Kindle, but man, some, if it's a reference book, I want a hard copy. So I have that paper. I can go back and dog ear pages and highlight things. So I think the book's really unique, and it is a bit of a strategy, and it talks about how video is the most powerful tool in business. So can you tell me about what you really want people to take away from this book and why people should dive into this and really think about legendeering?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think some of that actually stems from the term itself, right? What I want people to take away from this is that I call it a strategy, right? I use the word strategy a lot in the book. I use it on the front cover, right? I refer to it as a strategy because what I want people to take away from this is that it all, like, at the end of the day, good communication is very intentional, right? It is strategic, and it really, I think, when best executed, it doesn't feel that way to the end consumer, but it is, right? And so I want people, like when I say the term itself, right, is really sort of ties into what I want people to take away from the book. Legendeering is a made up word, right? Like, I 100% made it up, but I'm good with that. And I actually kind of like it because, you know, I feel like I'm in good company. I mean, Velcro is a made up word, right? Google is a made up word. Kleenex is a made up word, right? These are all things that we use in the public discourse on a daily basis, right? They're all made up words. So I'm good with that. But really where I came up with the term was I was kind of thinking of a word that would convey the idea that ultimately what I want to teach people to do and push people towards is engineering story, right? Very intentionally, methodically constructing story around their brands and their businesses. And so that's where I came up with legend for story, because story didn't combine well with engineering. It sounded really weird. But legend did. So I decided to go with legendeering because it kind of rolled off the tongue a little bit for me. And when I kind of did a little beta testing and tried it out with people, I got an overwhelmingly positive response from it. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, I like the title because, you know, when you're telling stories, if you're not just telling one, you're trying to create your own legends, your own, you know, set of stories that people can connect with. So yeah, I think it's a really appropriate title for your book. I love it. One of the things that I think really connected with me, you know, I haven't said it the same way, but I've certainly experienced it, is that when you're working with clients or a company's trying to do this themselves, oftentimes they think telling their story means telling the executive stories or telling the founder stories. That might be a part of it, but it's about way more than that, isn't it? So for you, what is it about?
I mean, absolutely. I think the classic mistake that a lot of businesses and organizations make is that they are heavily focused on information, particularly information that is important to them, right? Information that they hold dear, that they're excited and passionate about. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be excited and passionate about it, but it makes me think of, and this is a phrase I use to help describe this feeling to people often, is I say to business owners, right? And when I'm talking to groups of people about this, I say, no one is ever going to love your baby the way you love your baby.
Yeah. And everyone's bored when you talk about it too much.
Exactly. And everybody's been in the situation where they've been trapped in a conversation with someone who is showing them baby pictures that they don't want to see, right? So Nolan, you love your baby in a way that no one else ever will, right? And you have to understand that. And what you have to do is then shift your thinking to put your audience ahead of yourself, right? To put your audience first and to make sure that you're delivering for them, right? And the key directives that I lay out in the book, one of them is, you know, is, you know, your audience comes first, right? Is to put your audience first. But the others all kind of push you in that direction as well.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's so important. I mean, I've been working in brand for 30 years. And honestly, I think one of the things I've said to leaders or executives or heads of companies or marketers, CMO, more than anything else is, why should anyone care? And it's not about you. You know, like audience first and reaching them emotionally is the entire game, you know? And we've all been bombarded by lists of features and benefits. We've all been bombarded by me. Aren't we the greatest? We're the greatest company ever. We are so great. I think that gets tuned out now more than ever. So trying to find how you can reach your audience while you tell your story, but it's the action of reaching your audience tells a story. Every action you take tells a story.
Yeah, well, and I think the approach you're describing that a lot of businesses take actually fails in more than one way, right? So it fails in the way that your audience doesn't care in the same way that you do, right? Like, why should they care? The answer is they probably don't care the way you do. So it fails in that way. But then the other way that it fails is by creating content where you're essentially just laundry listing information at people. You don't give them context through which to relate to that information and therefore retain it, right? Like one of the things that's a relatively broadly accepted opinion in anthropology is that storytelling and the ability that storytelling gave us as a species to pass on generational information, generational knowledge from one generation to the next over time is one of the key turning points in our evolution that led us to be able to live in organized cooperative societies like we do now, right? Is that ability to tell stories that convey information. And all of us have experienced that, right? Like how many nursery rhymes did we hear when we were growing up? And when you go back and you look at the words associated, like in those nursery rhymes, the lines in them, they contain important information. Like Ring Around the Rosie was actually originally a nursery rhyme developed for kids to help teach them how to avoid contracting the bubonic plague.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Right? Like it really is. Storytelling is an incredibly powerful tool. And what you have to do in order to make information stick is to give it context for the audience, right? Context that they can relate to.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone responds much more strongly to emotion than they do a bunch of facts or a bunch of statements or a bunch of, let me talk about how great our product or how great our brand is. And, you know, we're biologically programmed to look for stories, find stories, and learn from stories from, you know, the time we were sitting around fires to now. You know, the phenomenon of why traffic slows down for a car accident is the same principle. Everyone slows down because you're programmed to try to learn something. Like, oh, going too fast right there is bad and you crash. Very simple story, but that's actually why you slow down. You know, that's just who we are.
Yeah, and you don't just rubberneck and like look out of morbid curiosity. Like at least I know I'm aware of this, and maybe I'm more aware of it than the average person because of what I do and how my brain has been trained to think. But I try to deconstruct what happened.
Yeah, I think me too.
I look, you know, across the lanes at the car sitting on the side of the road, and I go, okay, what happened? Like, do they have a flat tire? Is there another car involved? Where's their front end damage on that car, rear end damage on that car? Could they rear ended them? You know, do I think somebody hit the brakes? Were they going too fast? Were they avoiding something? Like, you know what I mean? Like instantly in my brain, I'm running through all these scenarios. And exactly to your point, I'm likely programmed to do that so that I don't make the same mistake that they made.
Yeah, you're trying to learn, which is, you know, why we watch the things we watch, you know, whether they're scary or whether they're, you know, beautiful. We watch because part of us is experiencing the world through them, which is why I think video can be so powerful, because it's such an experiential medium. You know, it's like being there. So you can see a lot, sense a lot, and learn. You know, whether you're learning something emotionally or you're relating to it to try to define who you are, that's the power of story. So part of what you write about in your book is that there's a lot of bad video out there. And I love that your book tries to help people make better video. So can you talk about, I mean, I know you've seen a ton of bad video, and how you encourage people to, you know, get a little bit better at this?
Yeah, I mean, ooh, it's like, where do I start?
Yeah, I know, right?
I mean, I think generally I'll start, I try to keep it like 10,000 feet, right? When we talk about this kind of stuff. So I think big picture is where to start. And again, it's about intentionality, right? It's about having a strategy. I think one of the key mistakes that people most often make with the video content they create is they do it haphazardly, right? They're throwing mud at the wall to see what sticks. So the metaphor that I use to try to help people get over that hump is one that potentially dates me a little bit, but I'm okay with it because I think it still works. But it's a road trip metaphor, right? And so what I tell people to do is when you're thinking about creating content, right, around your brand or for your business or even for your personal brand, right, if you want to be a content creator, whatever the case may be, if you're going to create content, the first thing you need to do is sit down and figure out what you want that content to do for you and for your brand and for your business and for your audience. What do you want to accomplish, right? Where do you want to end up? What's the destination of your road trip, right? That's the first thing you do when you plan a road trip. You don't just get in the car and start driving around in circles and look at the person sitting shotgun and go, where do you want to go?
Where do you want to turn?
Like, yeah, you want to start with the destination in mind, right? So the first thing you do is pick the destination, right? And then, you know, when I was learning how to drive, my parents bought me a Rand McNally road atlas, right? And because I learned to drive in a world where GPS units didn't really exist, right? And smartphones weren't even a dream on the horizon yet. Cell phones you could carry in your pocket were barely a thing, right? When I was learning how to drive. So I had to learn how to plan out a route on an atlas. And that's the skill set that I go to, right? Is I pick the destination and then I sit down and I methodically plan out the route. What road do I want to take? How long do I want to be on that road? When do I want to turn off of that road? Why do I want to turn off on that road? Why is it better or worse or different? In what way is it different? Right? All of those things go through my mind when I'm making these decisions when it comes to content creation.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people skip that.
Oh, yeah. I would say the majority of people skip that. And I would say even people in the industry are guilty of skipping it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they respond to a client whim or they look at a trend and all of a sudden they're doing the trend and then they're doing another thing. It's like content ADHD.
I heard it put best by someone one time who said, you know, if you ever find yourself chasing trends, what you're going to find yourself on a hamster wheel and you're never going to get to where you want to go. Right. Because if it's a trend, you're already too late. You're already behind.
Yeah, you're right. You're just driving in circles, following someone else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you're never getting any closer to your goal.
Yeah. And I think one of the cool things for anyone listening to please check out, this book, I think what your book is really helpful and really help people do, whether you're marketers or whether you're listening and you're thinking about your own brand or how you express yourself on LinkedIn or any of the reasons that you might be interested in telling your story better, is that video is a really powerful way to do it. And I love how you talk about episodic video content and sort of having a roadmap of where you want to go, but also like thinking about it as episodes and giving people different moments and different ways of seeing the story, because every single way doesn't connect with every single person. So you're creating more of opportunity for people to come in and believe in your story or follow your story or enjoy your story or embrace your brand. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that second part of your strategy is so important.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I almost found it surprising in when I moved from the entertainment industry to working with businesses. I almost found it surprising that in the business world, no one thinks of creating episodic content.
I know, it's crazy.
And I felt it was so surprising to me because we are served episodic content everywhere, yeah, right? When you think about this podcast that people are listening to, you know, right now, yeah, is episodic.
It is.
Right? The TV shows that we all love, that we grew up with, that we watch now, that we'll watch in the future, are episodic. Yeah. The morning radio show that people might listen to while they're commuting to work is episodic.
Yeah.
Right? The evening news is episodic. And for some reason, despite the fact that we get served episodic content everywhere we look, businesses have completely avoided doing it. And it doesn't make any sense to me because clearly people like episodic content, and there's a whole host of reasons why it works.
Right.
But you wouldn't have like unbelievable historic success in the television industry over the last 50 years, right? Billions and billions and billions of dollars in revenue generated through the creation of episodic content if it didn't work.
Yeah. I'm 100% there with you, and it's amazing that businesses avoid it. I think businesses think it's like a one and done. Like, oh, well, we did our video. We did our business video. Let's put it out there. We'll put it on our website that no one goes to, and it'll be on our homepage that no one will ever watch, and we're done. And, you know, when you look at brands, you know, there's brands who do it incredibly well, the Patagonias of the world, or the Liquid Deaths of the world, who are doing like really groundbreaking episodic content to where you don't know what to expect next, but you're looking forward to it anyway, because it's always going to surprise you. So yeah, I think that's incredibly powerful, and it's a really missing ingredient with a lot of content creators. I think a lot of influencers understand it because they've gotten to the point where they're like, I better just film what I'm doing every day and make it entertaining, which is episodic content. All of a sudden, like, I'm interested in this person. Today they're going to the beach. I don't know why I care that they go to the beach, but I'm going to watch them go to the beach. I mean, what's that all about?
If you're doing a vlog is episodic, right? By definition. But yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gotten on the phone with somebody or been in a discovery meeting with a business where they've said to me, they've used the exact phrasing, we need a video.
Yeah, man, I've been there.
And I'm sure I can tell, like, your reaction to that,
yeah,
says to me that you have had countless, yep, meetings exactly like that.
I've heard that over, well, and over again. We need a video. Really? Just, yeah, one, huh?
Yeah. Okey-doke. Let's change that to, we need video content.
Yeah, we need a video content strategy that works for us. And, you know, the clients that embrace it and actually start to do some episodic content, whether it's complex or very simple or both, win, you know? Like, and again, I think when you see companies that do it more than one way, where they're not just doing like, okay, we came up with this idea for a show, we're doing the show, great. Maybe it's complex, maybe it's expensive, but if it works, it works. But there's also some really simple ways to do episodic content that brands can embrace. So I love that your book dives into this. And I think there's some real value for listeners. So please go out and get Tom's book. It's this, especially the strategy part and what he can help you think about video content differently. I think it's really, really strong.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks. I appreciate that. And, you know, I mean, the goal too was like, honestly, I think there's really, I got asked early on when the book was like, kind of when I was finished with the first draft of the manuscript and I was talking to people about the book and they would ask me, who is your book for, right? Who's the audience for your book? And so I said, I think there's actually two audiences for my book, right? I think the primary audience, like who I initially envisioned when I wrote it, were entrepreneurs, you know, business owners, marketers who were looking for a better way to really connect with and build community around their brands, connect with people and build community around their brands, right? So that was the primary audience that I had in mind when I originally started writing the book. But I came to realize that I think the secondary audience is much broader. And to me, the secondary audience are consumers, right? The consumer public. And it's because I believe that I believe there's something fundamentally broken with the way businesses talk to people. And the way I kind of describe it to me, again, I'm a very visual person, surprise, surprise. But the way I describe it is, you know, you walk into a convenience store and there's that little skinny little ATM sitting by the door, right? Well, imagine that ATM sprouted arms and legs and it was walking around. And the communications that we get from businesses are the equivalent of them essentially button mashing on the keypad of that ATM. And when they get the right combination of content and they get the right code on that keypad and they get some cash out of the ATM, they keep hitting that code until that ATM is out of cash, and then they move on to the next one, right? They don't treat people. Businesses have been taught over the last, you know, 50 years, 40 plus years, really, you know, between people who I do not hold in high esteem, Milton Friedman and Jack Welch, to name two of the sort of big ones who are responsible for kind of the current state of the business world. Really, businesses have been taught to not treat people like people. They've been taught to treat people like dollars and cents on a P&L, right? To treat people like data points on a spreadsheet and not to treat them like human beings. And that's, I think, fundamentally an error in the long term. It's not sustainable. And I want to try to fix it. That's that whole humanizing thing comes in. And so I believe that if the broader consuming public reads my book, it will give them, it will arm them with a better understanding of the way businesses could be and should be communicating with them so that they can demand better. And if the marketplace demands it, businesses will deliver.
Yeah. I love that, man. That's a great summary of your book and a great reason for anyone to get it. And then also I think it has a ton of practical advice that leads you in that direction, you know, and I completely agree with you. I think the businesses, and especially in the age of AI and everything going on, how fast the world is, the more human your business is, the more connection you build, the more successful you're going to be. This is an entirely human endeavor, you know, like 100%. All of our success comes from being human about what we do, you know, trying to genuinely help people.
I really appreciate you saying that too, from somebody who's, you know, who I hold in high regard, from everything that I've seen of all the work that you've done, of the episodes of the podcast that I've listened to, the things that I've read that you post online. You know, I think, you're very well accomplished, in the field. And I really appreciate your thoughts on that. It means a lot to me to know that other people in, you know, related industries, to mine, can see and appreciate, and want to support what I'm trying to accomplish.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I appreciate you saying that. And honestly, I think from as soon as you and I started reading each other's stuff, we were like, oh, kindred spirit, you know?
Yep.
And you know, to bring this full circle back to an old friend of yours, Will Gadara, you know, it's one of the reasons that people ask me like, oh, if I want to read a book about brand, you know, I believe it or not, I say, you know, Unreasonable Hospitality by Will Gadara. It's the best brand book anyone's ever written. Because if you want a powerful brand, treat people like that. Think about hospitality. And I would say with your book, if you want to tell your story, do it in a human way and be organized about it. You know, don't be haphazard and don't try to get. That's the problem with most, even videos people make, they want to get something. You know, every time, if you go into every situation just wanting something from someone else, you know, we all love that. Don't we?
Nobody likes it.
No, right? Nobody likes it. So why is everyone doing it?
It doesn't all have to be a transaction.
No. And the more it is, the less you get. I think it's counterintuitive.
And I keep telling people, I'm like, don't believe the marketing hype. Everything has to have a call to action. It doesn't.
God, thank you. Preaching to the choir.
Sometimes it's okay to just give a gift.
Yeah. Like a lot, actually, you know, yeah. It's kind of Gary V's like jab, 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 left hook. Like, let's have a lot more putting out things that please you and then every once in a while asking.
Right. I mean, like, look, you send flowers to somebody or send a gift to somebody and you attach a card to that gift, right? Do you also put an envelope in so they can send you something back?
No, you don't.
No, of course not.
If you did, they would be like, I hate this person.
Yeah. You'd have not very many friends.
All right, let me ask you a couple of quick questions and get you out of here. Thank you so much for being here today, man.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
This was a blast, and I'm happy we get to help spread the word of your book. I know you worked really hard on it, and I think there's a ton of helpful advice for people out there trying to figure out how to tell their stories or build their brands. So, yeah, I really appreciate you putting it out there, and I think you do a great job talking about it. So real quick, just a couple like real fast questions. What would you name this chapter of your life right now? Because I know you got a lot going on.
So I've listened to the podcast, so I knew this was coming, and I put some thought into it. and I think the best term I could think of was the runway. And it's really because I feel like I'm at a point professionally and even personally where I'm really starting to hit my stride, where I'm really starting to get up to speed, and I'm really starting to feel like I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing. And I kind of think of that as like when you're on the runway, like in a plane on the runway, which, you know, given my career in television, spent, I don't know how many hundreds of that, you know, tens of thousands of hours in planes over the years. Right. But when you hit that speed on the runway just before liftoff, right? Like where you know you're about to take off, but you haven't yet, but you know it's coming. Right. That's kind of where I feel like I am.
That's a great place to be, man. Yeah. I mean, you've been putting yourself out there a lot and adding a lot of value, quite frankly, for other people like this book. And I think, you know, your intention, it seems like in everything you do that I see, is to add value for others. So I can understand why you'd be at a point where you feel like things are just, you're hitting the good spot where you're taking off, because I think you're bringing a lot to other people, and that's what does it. So what's a trait of yours that you used to think was a weakness that now you actually see some value in?
This, you know, I have a hard time with this a little bit. I mean, maybe it's the fact that I'm overly verbose.
Well, it came in handy when you're writing a book.
Also, you know, as I start to do more public speaking, it comes in handy when you're put on stage in front of a group of people to deliver value for them. So maybe talking too much my entire life is ultimately going to pay off.
That's awesome. I love that. All right. So last question. If you could give your younger self any advice, what would it be, man?
Yeah, this is a tough one too, because I think too that I wouldn't listen to it.
Yeah, right.
I'm thinking back to myself in my 20s,
yeah,
and there's almost no chance I would actually listen to the advice that I would give myself.
No, we sucked in our 20s, but give it a shot anyway, you know?
Here's what I would say, is I would tell myself to stop worrying so much about the future and focus more on enjoying what's happening right now.
Well, I love that. I think that's universally good advice, whether you're at that a younger moment in your life or today. You know, I think we spend way too much time letting our energy lead to the future or the past. So, well, man, I'm super glad we had this time together. This was awesome. So thank you.
Likewise.
Yeah. Thank you so much for, you know, coming on and letting our audience hear about your really cool book and all the things you've done. I think people will really enjoy this episode, and we'll put up a landing page. We'll have links to your book and links to your LinkedIn, and please, anyone listening, go follow Tom. I think you really enjoy it, and get a copy of his book, because there's some real value in it for anyone trying to tell their story.
I appreciate that, Steve. Thanks so much for having me here. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and to have this conversation and share it with your audience. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome, man. It was a blast. Thanks for being here. Want to hear more inspiring stories? Subscribe on your preferred podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And if you like what we're doing, please rate, review, and share. It's the best way to support us. Thank you for listening to Brand Story.